Whether we agree or agree to disagree, everybody's got an opinion. And I'm about to give you mine. So sit back, relax, buckle up, and try not to get offended. Welcome to This Canadian Thinks. Since the close of the pandemic, the world has slowly moved towards some sort of post-pandemic normalcy. There's still a smattering of people in public sporting a mask, and recently, with the onset of fall, health officials have begun to encourage the rest of us to do the same. But for the most part, it's finished. Most Canadians have reached the point where they are simply over the pandemic. It's going to be very difficult to get them to socially distance and mask up, or dictate when they're allowed to be in public again after the lifting of restrictions. Aside from the pandemic having simply run its course, becoming regarded as something akin to the seasonal influenza that it most assuredly is, their own science has always pointed to a type of herd immunity, which is where we must be by now, according to the modeling they offered us then. Beyond the loss of human life sustained during the time and the dissolution of democratic rights and freedoms, there are lasting repercussions, things that have not returned to normal as we knew them pre-pandemic.
New polling from Ipsos shows while 1 in 5 Canadians feel things are normal now, the same proportion say they're not sure they'll ever be ready to live without masks or vaccine mandates. But regardless of when people think the new normal will arrive, 64% of Canadians say they believe governments are not doing enough to get us there.
Well, we seem to be pretty ready. And that's what's being communicated out of the research. But, you know, it really is interesting that almost 20%, 1 in 5, say to us that they don't think they'll ever be ready, that we'll ever be going back to normal. So even though we're saying that we want to get back to something that resembles a normal life, we're still pretty tentative.
If you've been out to eat in the past year, you may have noticed a downward trend in overall quality, portions, and service, married to a steady increase in prices. As exciting as it was to once again break free of the confines of our homes to dine in local eateries, what we got was not the same once we got there. Far from it, in fact. Many excuses have been made for this, from supply chain issues, lack of workers, increased wages, the rising cost of raw materials and transportation, to name just a few. It seems as though we went from calling our orders in to them calling in their occupational performances. Even the most high-end establishments seem to have lowered the bar considerably in terms of overall quality and presentation. It's as though no one is even trying anymore.
Hey, you call this food?
My sandwich tastes like a fried boot.
My sandwich is a fried boot!
Some of you may be shocked to find out that the restaurant industry is still being subsidized financially by the Canadian government, even though regular citizens were no longer eligible for benefits as of November of 2022. I know I was. Not only are we receiving the most lackluster experiences offered to date, but as taxpayers, we are paying them for it through the Canadian Emergency Wages Subsidy. Meanwhile, the industry cries they aren't able to find staff without hiring temporary foreign workers to fill the available positions. If restaurants are hiring temporary foreign workers or being offered wage subsidies as well, then aren't we subsidizing those workers on two different levels? First, at the temporary foreign worker level where we subsidize wages to make them more affordable, which is a fancy way to say allowing companies to pay a rate below minimum wage by having the government pay the difference with your tax money. Then secondly, the government gives the restaurant a wage subsidy to offset the overall cost of wages further for everyone else on their payroll. This gives temporary foreign workers a very lucrative allure. No wonder companies would want to have it appear as though there's a shortage of Canadian-born applicants. It's not financially advantageous to hire Canadians. The incentive simply isn't there. Curiosity would have one wonder how many of the employees benefiting from the Canadian Emergency Wage Subsidy Program are temporary foreign workers, migrants, or refugees.
Across Canada, the signs are clear. Bosses are looking for workers. The pandemic brought labor issues into focus, some sectors in desperate need of employees. Construction, trucking, hospitality, agriculture.
There's more we could grow than we can harvest. We could grow more food. It's labor is our main constraint a lot of the time.
We need a skilled, agile, and inclusive workforce to support a growing economy.
Canada's new employment minister says his government can help. Under the Temporary Foreign Worker Program, so-called trusted employers who've repeatedly brought temporary workers to Canada while following program rules can keep employees for 3 years instead of the usual 18 months. Their application process will also be streamlined. The pilot will cost just over $29 million.
Without localized representation in the workforce, the regional identity is lost, as with the gratification of serving the surrounding community. the pride of a job well done. It's easier to do the bare minimum when you don't know anyone in the area personally, which was the case pre-pandemic for sure, but it has become increasingly worse. Now, because people spent a few years eating their own ichiban, it seems to be okay to present something similar at the restaurant level, simply because you should be happy to be out and not having to boil the water yourself. Where's the value? It certainly isn't in their offerings. Bridge Brand or Sysco packaged prepared meals is really the only difference at the middle class level. Most menus are identical otherwise. Original fare all but reserved to the most expensive and inaccessible of dining establishments.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
But of course.
Oh, thank you. Are you putting Grey Poupon on a wiener?
No, no, it's not a wiener. It's a frankfurter.
Oh.
Why? Is that a bologna sandwich you're applying my Grey Poupon to?
That's bologna.
God forbid you might complain. Along with the terrible service and poor product, there's been a table turned on customer retention as well. At one time, the customer was always right. These days, complaints are viewed as a form of abuse, a type of verbal assault that will absolutely not be tolerated under any circumstances whatsoever. Little to no effort is actually taken to acknowledge or rectify problematic service or product offerings. Yet, we are expected to continue to subsidize this lack of service. In fact, the restaurant industry clamors for more money, stating that their industry is on the verge of collapse and most restaurants days away from closure without some sort of financial intervention on behalf of the government.
Matthew Senecal Junkier owns this restaurant in downtown Vancouver. Pre-pandemic, it was a breakfast and lunch hotspot, but the daytime office crowd never rematerialized after COVID, so they turned the back into a wine bar in the evenings. It's now an essential part of their business.
The dynamic and the drivers of the business have completely changed pre- and post-pandemic.
One of the biggest challenges right now, soaring inflation. Menu prices in BC went up an average of 6% last year, despite cost increases of up to 30%.
So I think there's sticker shock. You know, when we opened the business, a $9 sandwich sounded really expensive. And today, you know, with the cost of ingredients that we use, a $14 sandwich is too cheap.
Labor shortages are another major sore spot.
80% capacity is all restaurants are operating at because of the labor shortages. We've had two-thirds of our members that are cutting operating hours because they just don't have the staff.
And the third blow, pandemic-related debt. He says nearly a quarter of restaurants that have yet to repay COVID loans will never be able to fully do so.
So the combination of those factors make it really difficult for restaurants to generate the income to become profitable. And what we saw in the latest numbers is an alarming number that 51% of restaurants are not making any money. They're unprofitable.
The deadline to pay back federal loans is December 31st, which is a one-year extension from the original date. But the restaurant industry is lobbying the federal government to extend that deadline another 36 months, and they want Ottawa to respond by the end of this month. In BC, the restaurant sector has spent the last few weeks pressuring the provincial government for extra support. Now, help is coming.
But we do know that a number of small businesses are feeling the impact, what we might really call a COVID hangover. So we've been taking those meetings and we'll be announcing something shortly.
But for many restaurants right across the country, they're nearing a tipping point and can't afford to see their margins squeezed any tighter. Tanya Fletcher, CBC News.
What about taking on some of the responsibility as business owners themselves? What about putting some effort into events or specials to draw customers into their establishments? What about updating the menu, using original recipes instead of ordering prepackaged meals from the large retail chain providers? What about hiring and firing staff based on their customer service abilities and cumulative complaints from customers? None of these things are mentioned, even though they have far more to do with the success or failure of a restaurant than how much the government is willing to pay to subsidize the staff. Unfortunately, this is the post-pandemic mentality that seems to prevail. Don't even get me started on the new trend where it seems we're expected to tip the person who sells you a stick of gum. Here's a tip for you. Do more than the very least that is expected of you, and people will go out of their way to tip you and thank you personally. Stop expecting a top dollar wage for minimum wage performance.
Michael, have you finished that evaluation?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, can I have it? Just that I need to present to the board on Monday.
Of course you can.
Nah. Now.
It's not strictly in paper format.
Right, so you haven't done it?
No, I have done it. It's just in my head.
Recently, it was discovered that one of the contributing factors behind Alberta's shortage of doctors and nurses was the fact that many healthcare professionals are moving to Saskatchewan, where they're paid more for doing considerably less. While most of us would like to work far less for a higher wage, it speaks to the overall disinterest in doing an exemplary job. Everyone is looking to do the bare minimum. There seems to be no satisfaction in going the extra mile anymore, although you can't exactly blame them. After years of being forced to submit to mandates and modified work schedules, in many cases against their own personal wishes, healthcare workers are exhausted from being constantly engaged with their fight or flight response. We all are. Which is why going back to restrictions is going to be a hard sell for most. Even those who went along without question are likely to oppose it another time.
People like myself picked up their COVID, not in the hospital, but in, you know, at a restaurant or from family members.
Albertans have been masking up for over 3 years to enter any AHS site, be it a hospital or a lab, but all that is about to change. Alberta Health Services will remove the requirement to masking at hospitals, labs, and continuing care centers starting Monday, saying the decision is based on declining COVID-19 cases and wastewater data.
A statement from AHS says other contributing factors to the decision include testing positivity rate and hospital admission rates for respiratory illnesses in Alberta, as well as consultation with stakeholders, including patients, their families, and frontline managers. This news has brought relief to some and worry to others.
I have a baby in the NICU, and so taking a little bit of extra caution has been like my mentality, my wife as well. So masking hasn't been a problem for us. So, you know, if they feel like they're ready to lift it, then I'm probably going to just trust their decision.
It's not a good decision. I don't like to wear, but inside I wear because of the safety of my patient and other patients.
AHS says masks and PPE will continue to be available for patients and healthcare workers who want to mask up, but as of June 19th, it won't be mandatory. Infectious diseases expert Dr. Daniel Gregson says it has been hard to communicate with patients through a mask, and many of his fraternity members will probably not mask up where it's not required.
I think many other jurisdictions have done this, like most recently Saskatchewan and BC in April. And we know we haven't really seen major issues in those jurisdictions. And at some point in time, you know, we can't be wearing masks forever. So it's probably a reasonable time to do this as the summer season comes and the amount of transmission we see in the community decreases.
Dr. Gregson stresses, though masking is not compulsory anymore, yet Albertans should mask up if they feel sick or they are in the company of immunocompromised people.
That isn't to say that some people aren't still adorning the mask when they go out in public as though they may be victims of Stockholm Syndrome. One can only hope that they're wearing it because they themselves are sick and not to protect them from illness. That's the one thing we should have learned from this whole debacle. If you're sick, stay home. If you can't stay home and must go out in public, wear a mask. That's it. Pretty basic, really. Far more effective than mask compliance, vaccine acceptance, or the mask mandates they forced on the populace during the pandemic.
Let's say you get kidnapped. For real. Right? And during the course of the kidnapping, somehow you fall in love with your kidnapper. It's rare, but it happens. It's called Stockholm Syndrome.
Restaurants and healthcare staff aren't the only ones calling in their performance. Governments, too, are operating in a rather unacceptable fashion at every stage from your local municipality to the federal jurisdiction. Even they seem to think it completely natural to focus on benefit over effort. Just recently, they passed an extension to remote work and are seeking to enshrine it into legislation in the very near future. Politicians don't even have to attend Parliament anymore. Instead, they are able to attend virtually, via video call or phone. On top of that, they're looking to limit days in session to 4 per week instead of the current 5, after giving themselves all a hefty wage increase recently as well. More expensive, less effective, depreciated program offerings and services abound from the ground floor to the governing level.
Members of Parliament are once again able to work remotely. A motion has passed in the House of Commons to resume hybrid sittings. The Liberals and New Democrats voted in favor of outnumbering votes against the Conservatives and the Bloc Québécois. The NDP supported the Liberals in putting an end to 2 days of debate. The motion gives MPs the option of participating virtually in proceedings.
While Liberal staffers do their best to convince the average Canadian about the benefits of austerity amid the highest inflation Canada has ever seen, Articles have surfaced reporting that Justin Trudeau's Easter vacation in Montana cost $250,000. That's right, $250,000, courtesy of John Q. Taxpayer. There hasn't been this much disconnect between the governing class and the citizenry since Marie Antoinette proclaimed, "Let them eat cake." You may remember how well that worked out in France.
And when they went to the Queen to tell her her subject had no bread, do you know what she said?
Let them eat cake.
When a company spends money, it's referred to as their burn rate. The idea is to never spend more capital than you have available at any rate beyond that which you are able to replace it. Canada's burn rate is off the charts. Any competent leveraging company would have divested long ago, and in fact, Canada has seen our credit rating recently having been downgraded already, even though Liberal staffers would never admit it. According to them, our 3-star credit rating and lowest debt in the G7 is proof that the current government is fiscally sound. Meanwhile, investment continues on a downward pace as more companies avoid Canada due to the fragile economics of the region.
I think it can be hard for people to judge, you know, is it fiscally responsible or isn't it? We're here in Ottawa. I think the House of Commons is behind us. There are lots of partisan talking points flying around. And so what I would say, you know, to you, but even more to people listening to us and watching us, I get that you don't want me to grade my own homework. And I get that hearing me say government is fiscally responsible, you want some proof points. So I'll give you 2 quick proof points. The first one is Canada's debt and Canada's deficit right now, today, are the lowest in the G7. That is significant. Second thing, and this speaks to, I don't believe we should grade our own homework. I don't expect you to want us to grade our own homework. There is someone out there whose job it is to give us a grade. And that is quite literally the ratings agencies. And the grade that the ratings agencies are giving Canada right now, today, is the highest grade possible, a AAA credit rating.
And that is because I have a good credit rating from my bank. Does that mean that I should increase the size of, you know, the staff that I have at my workplace, or, you know, at a pace faster than is needed, for example, in the public service? I mean, you've admitted to that pace perhaps being too fast, in that the cuts that you're now looking to make over the next 5 years are all focused on that.
The rating that the agencies give us is based on where we are today, and it's based on what they think is sustainable going forward. So they're looking at 2 things. They're looking at how strong is the economy and is it growing? So they understand you need to make investments to be sure you have growth. And what they also think about is the rate of investments in line with the expected rate of growth, with the return on those investments. That's what they're expecting of us. I think broadly that's what Canadians expect of us. And that is what we are absolutely committed to delivering. That's what we're doing.
Canada's total debt to date is over $65 billion. In a good year, revenues will total $30.8 billion. Federal interest payments were expected to reach $20.2 billion, or 7.3% of total federal revenues in 2020-2021, the latest numbers available to the public, which meant that the federal government was spending 7 cents on every dollar in revenue on interest payments as debt was rolled over. Interest payments on the national debt were $475 billion in fiscal year 2022, the highest dollar amount ever. Interest costs grew 35% last year and are projected to grow by another 35% by the close of 2023. In fact, our total national operating costs are roughly half the cost of the interest payments. We're paying twice as much in interest than it costs to operate the entire country.
Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland faces pressure to address affordability and Canada's housing crisis while not adding to the inflation problem in this country. The economic update pegged the deficit for the current fiscal year at about $40 billion, the same as the budget projected. But the deficit over the next few years after that is now bigger than forecast at budget. The cost to pay Canada's debt also rises due to that deficit and higher interest rates, reaching more than $60 billion in 2028.
This is someone who's doubled our national debt. He's added more debt than all previous prime ministers combined. Next year, we will spend more on debt interest in Canada than we do on health care.
There are also some new measures for housing, $15 billion in additional loan funding for rental apartments, but that money won't be available for another 2 years. Plus, proposed tax measures to crack down on non-compliant short-term rentals and a new Canadian mortgage charter, a codification of rules and expectations banks are expected to follow when working with borrowers, though it's not binding.
What the Liberal government has announced is not a budget, obviously. It's not even a mini budget. It is a micro budget. It does not meet the urgency of what Canadians are going through. It doesn't really meet their needs.
According to the Fraser Institute, in total, interest costs for Canadian governments, federal, provincial, and local, amounted to $67.7 billion in 2021-2022. This is nearly equivalent to the amount spent on pension benefits acquired through the Canada and Quebec pension plans, which amounts to $70.3 billion. It's also just under the $74.7 billion spent on public kindergarten to grade 12 education in Canada in 2019-2020, the latest year of available data. These comparisons enable us to demonstrate the scale of interest costs across the country. They also provide a sense of the extent to which debt accumulation diverts resources away from important public priorities. The Canadian government's burn rate more closely resembles an uncontrollable wildfire than anything remotely fiscally sound. It's as though politicians are trying to spend all the money there is at once in order to get rid of it before it's useless and they can usher in their beloved and much-touted digital currency once and for all.
Imagine a digital loonie becoming legal tender. Well, that day is getting closer. A recent survey found most major banks are considering some form of digital currency within the next 6 years. Three research teams have produced proposals for the Bank of Canada. As Eric Sorensen reports, this could fuel the digital economy.
Every day, more Canadians pay digitally. And fewer businesses need this. A cash drawer stuffed with bills. Canadians are among the most cash-free spenders in the world. So, is it time for digital currency? The Bank of Canada isn't promoting the idea, but believes it needs to be ready.
Currency is a core part of the Bank of Canada's mandate. For several years, the Bank of Canada has been analyzing what circumstances might lead Canada to decide to issue a digital currency.
The Bank of Canada is now studying proposals from three sets of university experts for a homegrown digital currency. Formulas for how to spend with the anonymity of cash without using cash. It could work like this. Through an app on a cell phone, a user sets up a secure e-wallet. It's authenticated through a government agency, and it's ready to go. The merchant establishes a digital transaction to accept the funds. But a critical new step in between, what the U of T and York team calls a whitelist, where the transaction is not only authenticated, but will ensure customer information is not passed on, just the money. Privacy is paramount.
We believe that the Canadian government has an obligation to give people a way to protect their privacy and give them, in particular, because payments are so central for commercial interactions.
The currency would require measures against too much privacy to prevent money laundering and tax evasion. And while cash payments are becoming a smaller part of the economy, the central bank says it wouldn't abandon communities not connected to high-tech commerce.
That means, for one thing, ensuring that remote and marginalized communities are not left out of any new way to pay for goods and services.
The so-called CBDC wouldn't be a direct counter to Bitcoin, which is an investment currency, rather than a cash-equivalent consumer currency. But Canada cannot sit back, say experts, as other countries like China unveil digital currencies and private enterprise cryptocurrencies such as Facebook's Diem are developed.
It's a matter of national sovereignty. So I don't think the Bank of Canada or any central bank for that matter would like to outsource this process to a third party, even if it is a domestic party, let alone a foreign one.
Only a central bank can guarantee complete safety and universal access, and with public interest, not profits, as a top priority.
Digital currency won't be issued before Canadians and Ottawa want it, but when they do, the Bank of Canada wants to be ready to roll it out.
Can you imagine how awful the rollout of a digital currency will be? The government couldn't organize a butt-kicking contest if the room was nothing but legs and butts. Not to mention that you can't trust them not to turn off your money whenever they feel like it, just like they did to participants of the Freedom Convoy. You must maintain some sort of tangible and physical currency, or you risk not only the government being deeply involved in every aspect of your financial background, but the eventual dissolution of the digital credit's merit. as the government balloons the economic environment by simply issuing more credits. And that's if there's any sort of limitation to the amount of digital currency that can be created. That's why you buy a fraction of a Bitcoin. The originator of the currency gave it a finite number of coins. There can only be so many. Now that each coin is worth extraordinary amounts of money, they are split up into pieces which are then broken down further yet again. You buy a piece, but it's still worth money. A government-backed digital currency will have no such limitation.
Are U.S. Treasury bonds still safe to invest in?
Very much so. I think there's a... This is not an issue of credit rating. The United States can pay any debt it has because we can always print money to do that. So there is zero probability of default.
An entire future episode will delve into the way money is created because it is far too onerous to articulate here and now. We are talking about the state of the world post-pandemic, but let's sum it up by saying, money based on a tangible thing like gold no longer exists. It has been replaced by a fiat currency system where money only represents a fraction of what is considered currency, and much of what is considered currency has little to no inherent value whatsoever. It simply exists on a banker's ledger while the financial institution further erodes your worth through a series of service charges and fees. However, given this, and the current state of the monetary system in general, it's easy to see how much worse it might be without the checks and balances of some sort of commodity-based currency going forward.
And what do you and your family do to cut back on plastics?
We have recently switched to drinking away from plastic towards paper, like drink box water bottles sort of things. There's a number of choices we can make as consumers that will do better, and every consumer needs to look at ways they can make smarter choices in their consumptions. We certainly do that on a daily basis as we've switched from plastic water bottles to paper water bottles or cardboard water bottles, but there's always more things to do, and we're looking forward to continue that.
Ineptitude and disorder is the rule of the day. You can expect the most ridiculous things to come out of a politician's mouth at this time as they attempt to weigh societal and moral dilemmas in a matter which is outside of their knowledge and their purview. Our elected officials are meant to represent their local constituents, but have far too much fun playing in the sand and meddling in the concerns of other jurisdictions. They're allowing the home fires to burn out while lighting wildfires in other places. While we are servicing an interest rate to international banks twice the cost of doing business, we are funneling millions upon millions out of Canada into other countries to solve problems that will one day be ours because they are neglecting to focus their concerns on matters of a Canadian origin. As though somehow saving Ukrainians will magically erase homelessness in Canada. Can you imagine the fresh drinking water, food, lodgings, and opportunities we could present to the Canadian population if we didn't send that money abroad? Many people arrive in Canada for a new life, not to fight the centuries-long wars they left behind in their homelands. They come to escape war, not to wage it. So how then is it that we can be pressured so adequately as to affect our efforts elsewhere? It's all manufactured anger anyway. If it weren't, then why was Ukraine obliterated from the news cycle the minute the Sword of Iron War kicked off? Think about it. When was the last time you heard the name Putin? Pierre Poilievre isn't wrong when he says it's time to bring it back home. Problem is, Pierre is no more likely to stop sending out foreign aid or supporting international causes than Justin Trudeau is.
What can I get you?
I'd like a large coffee.
Okay, so hot coffee?
Hot coffee.
Okay, room for cream?
Totally leave room for cream.
Why are you talking like that?
Why are you talking like that?
Because this is my voice?
This is my voice.
No, it's not. I heard you talking a minute ago. I know you don't talk like that.
Neither do you, because nobody actually talks like this. You choose to talk like this, and today I chose to talk like this.
Pretty annoying, isn't it?
Why are you so rude, man?
Just stop doing that.
I can't help it. It's my voice.
No, it's not. It's an affectation that annoying teenagers and rich people use to sound like they don't give a shit. Except you work in a coffee shop, so I know you're not rich, and you don't look like a teenager. Unless you're a Eunice Kennedy Shriver, knock it off.
So just because I talk like this means I don't give a shit? And what exactly am I supposed to not give a shit about?
That's an excellent question to ask yourself in your actual voice.
Excuse me. Some of us would like to order.
off.
You're a total dick, man.
There you go. Good. You're talking.
It's the same at all levels post-pandemic, from the barista making your coffee to your elected officials. Everyone is doing a half-baked job. Maybe it's because they're all on legalized marijuana. Who knows? There sure isn't the old college try anymore, though, that's for sure. It used to be that you set regulations and protocols and held everyone to the same degree. But these days, the government tells us that building codes and adequate training is racist, and we must alter our expectations so that those unqualified for the task are able to participate. Poilievre himself said he would fast-track migrants and refugees who were in Canada already so that they could more quickly apply for jobs in which they may be trained in their home country, but that might not meet the requirements of the current Canadian system. Which is a fancy way to say they do not have the expected standard of training and that it would be bigoted to expect that they might elevate their skill set to properly meet the requirements and competencies to successfully obtain said positions in Canada. Unless you've been living under a rock for the last decade, you likely already know that healthcare in Canada is in shambles. Do we really need more unqualified staff adding to the issue? How about getting them the additional training required instead of lowering our requirements? This isn't a third world country, and we shouldn't accept third world standards.
So, I'm happy to report we have succeeded in rebooting our flagships. Way ahead of schedule, yet again. This has allowed us to improve our USPs by 90%. That's 9 out of every 10.
Excellent. Thank you, Samuel. Timothy, what's the status with the Linear Solutions? Could you give us the latest on the Square project?
The Linear Solutions department has, yet again, functioned at full capacity, and we have fulfilled 114% of this month's objectives. You can read the handouts for a detailed account, but in short, as I reported last week, we've decided to use the right angle for the Square project. Now, there's still some debate as to how big a right angle is, so we're testing currently at 90, 97, 100, and 101 degrees. As agreed, I've ensured Anderson cross-checks the design, removing any left angles, and doesn't use them in future. Overall, we have very good progress with the design.
Are we on track with the schedule? When are we required to start delivering?
I'm happy to report that we are ready to start first deliveries tomorrow, which is way ahead of the requested delivery schedule.
We've only just finished system testing the prototype and are only halfway through performance testing. We haven't even released an alpha version yet.
As I said earlier, we've had very good progress with the design.
Yes, we've had very good progress, but I'd say the design of the product is only 75% complete.
Well, exactly. That's 3 out of every 4. So we're ready to start shipping tomorrow.
Doesn't work like that.
We'll produce, say, 4 units, but only ship the first 3. Then when you're finally 100% complete with the design, we can then ship the 4th.
Excellent work, Timothy. You can proceed with the production. Anderson, send me please a revised delivery schedule so I can share it with the client. Well, thank you everyone. This was very productive.
That's part of the problem, though. Nobody cares. People, for the most part, tend to take the path of least resistance. If their meal is cold and undercooked, they won't go out of their way to draw attention to it. They take a lackadaisical approach and say,
"What can I do? Still better than having to cook it myself."
Same thing with the government. Both sides are so sure that they're the only way to prevent the other, and then they do the exact same things once they get into power and everybody says,
"Oh well, what can I do?"
Well, you can start by realizing you're being played by both sides. Even that seems like too much to ask. The level of political disregard in Canada is near unbelievable. Almost as unbelievable is that next to no one is willing to do anything to hold them accountable for it. Maybe it's because the mass majority are also going through their day-to-day lives without challenging themselves or holding themselves to a higher standard either.
If there's one maxim the Trudeau government really likes repeating, it's this one. Diversity is our strength. But it turns out that when you ask the very diverse Canadian population their thoughts on this sentiment, they're not so sure. According to this Léger Post Media poll, a mere 24% agree with the idea that diversity is unambiguously a strength. Most everybody else strikes a more nuanced tone. It could be a strength, but having lots of different people living together can also cause problems if you're not careful. And this isn't some white backlash thing. Non-white respondents were actually slightly more likely to say, "Yeah, diversity's great, sometimes." That same poll also showed people weren't so hot on multiculturalism either. A majority said immigrants should be encouraged to adopt Canada's mainstream values and traditions and forget about anything that doesn't jibe with those.
That's the issue with having a non-nation state where absolutely everything is welcomed and embraced, including vastly different viewpoints that historically have had no history of peace. Without an ideal understanding of what Canadian values and belief sets are, then you are leaving the door open to allow centuries-old conflicts to land on our doorstep. Just look at all the pro-Hamas demonstrations that are being held all over Canada right now. They are literally celebrating a terrorist group in the streets of Canada. Meanwhile, Kazakhstanian terrorists are known to be living in enclaves in Surrey, British Columbia, yet nothing is done to deport them or otherwise. Some of them even receive taxpayer money. It's absurd. Although Canada has been developing a bit of a reputation as terrorist sympathizers for a while now. Just look at the $10.5 million the Trudeau government handed over to convicted terrorist Omar Khadr.
Breaking news now on confirmation that the Canadian government has issued Omar Khadr an apology and a monetary settlement. For details, I'm joined by CTV's Michel Boyer. He's with me in studio. Michel, we're just learning that the apology has come down. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, the Canadian government apologizing to Omar Khadr. I want to share part of it with you, word for word, what the government is saying in a statement just moments ago. We're announcing that the government of Canada has reached a settlement with Mr. Omar Khadr, bringing this civil case to a close. On behalf of the government of Canada, we wish to apologize to Mr. Khadr for any role Canadian officials may have played and any resulting harm. We hope that this expression and the negotiated settlement reached with the government will assist him in his efforts to begin a new and hopeful chapter in his life with his fellow Canadians. So this, of course, Marcia, is, you know, we've been talking about this all week, ever since it was leaked that he was going to get a reported $10.5 million. The government not saying that the figure that they settled for, though those figures were reached in mediation. Mediation is confidential. So we may never know officially from the Canadian government how much was settled for. But again, the apology to Omar Khadr for the government's involvement in his questioning when he was held captive while he was held in custody, I should say.
And that money, we've also learned, has already been paid out. This is not something that's pending. This has happened.
It's happened. It's done. It's in a bank account. What kind of bank account remains to be seen. Could be in a trust as well. But, you know, Omar Khadr, if he wanted this, had to act very quickly. We did have obtained documents from the court, Superior Court here in Toronto, that in fact the widow of the U.S. Army medic that was killed in Afghanistan had filed a motion to try and stop Omar Khadr from getting that money. But because the Canadian government moved swiftly on this, they were able to have the money wired to him, deposited into his account before any sort of litigation went forward that could have stopped that from happening.
Yeah, and that money is tax-free.
People complain about the police and their general ineffectiveness as well, and while granted they could likely do more, how did the police do their job when the government supports the criminals they are supposedly tasked with chasing? If you have ever had a car stolen or been scammed by some fraudulent individual, you've likely heard them say,
"We'll make a report of it, but don't expect anything. This sort of stuff happens all the time."
It's no different than the waitress who tells you that complaining about your steak is a form of unacceptable abuse. There is something they could do about it. They choose not to. Can't be easy for the cops either, though, having to cherry-pick what political targets they might do best to avoid while staying motivated to go to work and chase bad guys. All the while, the government introduces laws on a near-daily basis aimed at keeping those pursued out on the streets. And given those circumstances, it would be tough to remain excited about the job when picking up the phone after a while for even the most seasoned professional.
Police, what do you want?
I want to report a murder.
What else is new?
Hey, you gonna let me in or what?
Yeah, hang on.
Before you go any further, pal, I gotta tell you, it's cash up front. $1,000 a day for a full investigation, another $1,000 of the assailant's card. You understand?
Yeah. Hey, here's the dollar. Thanks for nothing.
Everyone is so eager for things to go back to the way they were pre-pandemic that they are willing to accept all manner of new normal. Things many wouldn't have given a nickel for before has them handing over exorbitant sums now in the pursuit of anything that even remotely resembles the past. Meanwhile, poor government planning prior and unabated spending during has left us with but a scarce reminder post-pandemic. blaming a litany of things for the lackluster offerings from supply chain issues to worker shortages and everything in between, rather than take any responsibility for the current situation themselves. The Liberal government simply cannot fathom they've done anything wrong or that there was any other alternate course of action whatsoever. That's the problem with progressives. They say they want to have an open dialogue, but are surprised when anyone has a differing outlook. Rather than take other points of view into account to make a fair and unbiased decision that is in the very best interest of every Canadian, they instead find ways to silence any oppositional voices or contrary opinions in an attempt to force their ideological agendas.
You have, throughout your mandate so far, launched some really big transformational spending initiatives that come with big price tags, but have had big societal impacts as well. Do you anticipate launching any more of those types of programs in the rest of your mandate?
I learned during the NAFTA negotiations, never answer a hypothetical. There is a lot of time between now and the next election. But I am glad that you point to the big transformational programs that are already underway. One of my favorites is early learning and childcare. We announced that in the 21 budget, and it is rolling out. And, you know, I think it is important for Canadians to recognize that our economic plan is something that is happening every single day. And, it can be announced in a budget, as with childcare in 2021, we are investing in it right now, and it's delivering for Canadians. With, you know, we now have fees down by 50% across the country. Six provinces and territories have $10 a day childcare, and that is really transforming families' lives. It's making life more affordable for families across the country, and it means a lot of parents, especially mothers, can now go out and work. That helps our economy with labor shortages, and it helps families.
And certainly, I'm not disagreeing with that point. It's actually with that program in mind that I asked the question. That program, something like the Canada Child Benefit, they do come, however, and not to take away from their effectiveness or their impact, with very large price tags, right? We're talking in the neighborhood in each of those programs of $10 to $20 billion a year.
Child care is $30 billion over five.
Right.
Like, that's a lot.
It's a lot of money, right? So I asked it not necessarily as a hypothetical, but against the backdrop of what you did outline in the fall economic statement, which was two promises where a fiscal anchor is concerned. The first, that you would lower the debt to GDP ratio in 24-25 and keep it, quote, on a declining track thereafter. The second, that you would get the deficit to GDP ratio below 1% by 26-27 and keep it there. Does that inherently limit you, though, from launching any kind of program similar to those?
So I am actually really glad that you put those two questions together, because from my perspective, we have a fiscally responsible economic plan because we need to have the capacity to invest in Canadians. We need to have the capacity to invest precisely in things like early learning and child care. And fiscal responsibility means that those investments are sustainable over the long term. So that's why our economic plan is really at its heart about investing in Canadians, investing to ensure that we have an economy that can deliver good jobs people can count on, that supports them with things like early learning and childcare. And the way that we can continue to do that is by making sure that all of those plans and programs are built on this fiscally responsible foundation.
So you have the capacity, let's say, to sustain the programs that you have right now. My question is whether you will have the capacity going forward, now having outlined these fiscal anchors. And I'm asking you because what I have noticed in public opinion polling is that a lot of Canadians are saying, what's this government's vision for the future? And so if you're going to present big transformational projects that do come with a high price tag, I am wondering if this fall economic statement actually limits you from doing so, or maybe you're not so wedded to those two promises.
Actually, I really believe our fall economic statement is about ensuring that we can continue to invest in Canadians, because what I really believe makes things like early learning and childcare possible is that they are built on a sustainable fiscal foundation, because that means we can keep on doing it year after year after year. And I really believe, Vashi, that the investments that we are making today, and those are investments, you're quite right, that are ongoing based on things we launched in previous budgets, those investments are going to deliver strong, sustainable economic growth that means we can continue to do more things for Canadians going forward.
Where does it end? If you think somehow that Pierre Poilievre is the answer to your prayers, then you're in for a rude awakening. The only thing that electing the progressive conservatives will accomplish will be to slow down the rate of progressivism. By no means will they stop it. Liberal light at best and red Tories at worst, the progressive conservatives agree on near everything but spending. While they dangle the cancellation of the carbon tax with one hand, they have no real solutions to the current problems faced by Canada. For example, instead of speaking out against migration, being opposed to the hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees and other undocumented or irregular border crossers, the progressive conservatives assert that making the entire border a crossing point will solve the problem. After all, it would remove the illegality of it and make their entry one of lawful nature. How is that putting Canada and Canadians first? How is that bringing it home? The only thing that is being brought home is the third world problems that come with permitting such things in the first place. So don't expect things to be any different should Poilievre get elected. In fact, expect them to continue in the same direction, just at a slightly slower pace. Everything will continue to rise in cost, migrants will continue to cross the border unchecked, and money will continue to flow out of the country to foreign jurisdictions. It's the illusion of choice and nothing but.
The minister was asked by Global News if he was tracking the whereabouts of 33,000 illegal border crossers. He claimed, quote, that the overwhelming majority of illegal border crossers had left the country. Yet today, the Globe and Mail reports that only six illegal border crossers have actually been removed by Canada and by his government. So a very precise question. If the government has moved six illegal border crossers, how many illegal border crossers remain in Canada?
Honourable Minister of Border Security.
Mr. Speaker, I know that the member opposite, because of her vast experience on the immigration file, knows that individuals who come to our country, cross into Canada, and seek the protection of Canada and asylum as they flee from persecution are not illegal crossers and are dealt with according to law. They are entitled by international convention and Canadian law to due process and humanitarian support.
The Honourable Member for Calgary Nose Hill.
Well, perhaps I created some confusion, Mr. Speaker. I asked him very clearly how many illegal border crossers remained in Canada and he couldn't answer. I'm going to ask what every Canadians want to know after that disastrous interview. If the minister can't tell the House how many illegal border crossers remain in Canada, how can they possibly expect to believe that he knows where they are? Where are they?
Honourable Minister of Border Security.
Mr. Speaker, under Canadian law, all people that are coming into this country seeking asylum are entitled to due process. When all of those processes have been exhausted and they are deemed ineligible, they are subject to removal by CBSA. The people that the member opposite is referring to are still engaged in that process, and when those processes are complete, the law will take effect.
Have you actually sat down and thought about the way life has been different since the pandemic? Is it better or is it worse? Chances are, like many, you haven't really given it much thought. After all, it's a period of time that most of us would rather forget. A resemblance to normal seemingly enough to serve the purpose. Comment with your personal experience. Let us know. How is your life different, if at all, since the pandemic? I'd like to personally take this moment to thank you for listening to This Canadian Thinks. We appreciate your support and look forward to creating more episodes for your listening pleasure. If you're able, please subscribe. Your support helps us afford the time to make these episodes in addition to helping us reach a wider audience. Some of you have recently reached out to ask why there's such a delay between episodes lately. While we're working on getting more episodes finished, it isn't easy to juggle a full-time occupation and podcast production. Most of the production is done in my free time, which is typically at a premium. This is why your interactions, comments, and follows are so important. If you're listening on a platform, please hit the follow button and be sure to hit the subscription and notification bell if you're watching on YouTube or Rumble. Remember to tell your friends and neighbors about This Canadian Thinks as well. Follow This Canadian Thinks on Facebook and X, and invite your friends and followers to do so too. The more exposure we get, the more episodes we'll be able to make. Every little bit helps. We've also started a GoFundMe to help offset the cost of advertising. Our first goal is to purchase some billboard advertisements and some Facebook ads and that sort of thing. Donations are already being pledged, and we can't thank the donors so far enough for their support. Perhaps you might consider donating as well, should you be able. Understandably, given the current inflationary liberal era, it's a wonder anyone can make ends meet at all, so don't worry if you're unable. This Canadian Thinks remains free for all to enjoy and we will never limit access to our podcasts through the use of a paywall or otherwise. However, if you are able and feel our program is worthwhile, we could definitely use your support. If you have any topics you'd like This Canadian Thinks to cover or ideas for guests who might be interested in appearing on a future episode, be sure to let us know. We are also actively seeking sponsors and advertisers who might be a good fit with our program. If you'd like to partner with us, we'd be happy to hear from you. Thanks so much once again for listening to This Canadian Thinks. We hope you'll be back for many more episodes to come. Until next time, keep your mind open and don't forget to think.
Proudly sponsored by TrampledUnderTyranny.com. Politically discordant, counterculture clothing for the discerning civil disobedient. www.TrampledUnderTyranny.com.